Chapter 7. The School System. A Decade of Cramming. Our system of small local districts was developed in a time when every little community was, of necessity, self-contained, and lived largely unto itself. The system is not arraigned because it is old, but because it is outgrown. It hampers development like a tight-fitting garment on a fast-growing boy. The life of the people unfolds, it develops, and new forms, new systems must be evolved to meet the new needs. Report of the Chief Superintendent of Education, Prince Edward Island, 1928.
Rural youth cannot be served by the one-roomed school in the field of secondary education. Apart from this, these schools are terribly expensive in that we cannot expect, nor do we get adequate returns for the money spent on them. Interim report for the Prince Edward Island Advisory Reconstruction Committee, July 1945.
When Alex Campbell came to power in mid-1966, no area was more ripe for change than the Prince Edward Island school system. The province had 412 operating schools, of which 252, or 65%, had only one room, with 8 grades and 1 teacher. Prince Edward Island had one of the worst grade 12 completion rates in Canada, and lagged in post-secondary participation. Educational administration consisted of 403 local districts, founded on 19th-century taxation and governance arrangements. The local districts were defined geographically by how far it was reasonable to expect students to walk to school, and qualitatively by how much or how little the district was prepared to pay the teacher as a supplement to the modest base salary provided by the province. The hand of history was heavy on the Prince Edward Island school system, reaching back to milestone political decisions from the 19th century. In 1852, Prince Edward Island became one of the earliest British colonies to have a Free Education Act, barring tuition for students over 5 years of age, and committing the colonial government to pay basic teacher salaries through a grant to local school districts. This commitment included a proviso that the schoolhouse could be not closer than 3 miles to any other school supported under the legislation. The Public Schools Act of 1877 ended a period of controversy over denominational schools by stipulating that all schools supported by the public purse would be non-sectarian, while sublimating issues of religion and education into a system of informal agreements and local initiatives that enabled varying degrees of religious instruction and identification, or not, in schools and communities across PEI. The 1877 law would go without substantial reform for more than 9 decades until 1971, notwithstanding 5 commission reports and innumerable calls by school inspectors and other authorities for the PEI school system to change.
Momentum for change.
By 1966, change was underway. With better all-season roads after the Second World War, it became possible to envisage consolidation, which started by cooperatively combining schools in some localities and through the creation of convent schools. Walter Shaw's government implemented a system of regional high schools beginning in 1961 with O'Leary and the Egmont Bay region, followed by 7 new regional high schools formed in 1961-62, and 4 more in 1962-63. The opening of Colonel Gray Senior High School in Charlottetown in October 1966 completed the province-wide high school system. Education Minister Dr. George Dewar would later liken the initiative to a great logjam that had been broken. Despite the advances made under the Progressive Conservatives, the PEI school system still faced monumental challenges. In the summer of 1966, the Campbell government's first challenge was to make good on a campaign promise to provide free school books. This was a sizable financial commitment, costing $537,000 in 1966-67, but it was a promise that kept on giving as the books were handed down in subsequent years. The immediate task was to physically deliver 194,000 textbooks to more than 400 schools within a period of 4 weeks. On August 22nd, Education Minister Gordon Bennett noted that the distribution was proceeding smoothly. Bennett offered high praise to the staff at the Department of Education and throughout the system for their part in what he called one of the biggest tasks ever undertaken by education officials in the province. the Campbell government turned its early attention to transforming the education system. In his September 1966 televised address, Campbell reported, "We have directed a professional study of the educational needs of our students from the elementary to the university level. This study will include a complete appraisal of the present school tax system." After some pestering from government, Acres Consulting produced a report in August 1967 that opened by stating, "In the past 50 years, little change occurred in the Prince Edward Island school system. The one-room school still exists as it did when first established." While the Acres report was obviously overstating the case to say that little change had occurred in the previous 50 years, it was not exaggerating to say that much remained to be done. In a beguilingly simple summary of its advice to government, the report recommended a three-step sequence of actions for implementing a consolidated plan as follows. Provide for financial reform, including tax equalization and central collection, etc. 2. Reform the political units for efficient school administration. And 3. Reform educational services. What these changes entailed was a massive centralizing and equalizing shift in taxation and school administration, a substantial program of school construction, a major upgrading of teacher qualifications and remuneration, the modernization of curriculum, and a significant commitment of resources. Acres estimated that operating expenditures for the elementary and secondary system would triple from 1966 to 1976, and that the envisaged capital program would involve building 449 additional classrooms by 1976 at a cost of $23 million.
Challenges, big and small.
Over and above the modernizing and centralizing, the Prince Edward Island education system was already running at a fast pace to keep up with the demographic realities of the post-war baby boom. Acres reported that the PEI secondary school enrollments had increased by an average of 5.5% annually since 1951. By 1966, the crest of the student population wave was already in the system, with an enrollment of just under 29,000 in grades 1 to 12. Acres projected that these numbers would begin to taper off modestly after 1969, to a total enrollment of 27,000 by 1976. By contrast, it was projected that there would be only 24,500 students in the system by 1976 if the reforms were not undertaken. In other words, without reform, there would be 10% or 2,500 fewer students in the PEI school system if the status quo were to continue. With the reforms, Acres projected a grade 12 completion rate of 69.8%, compared with 57.9% under the status quo. This was the essence of the report. In spite of the fiscal and political challenges, Prince Edward Island had no choice but to boost grade 12 completion rates. The report offered the summary argument: education is expensive, but it provides a very high rate of return on investment. The government would soon discover that it had neither the capacity nor the established processes to carry out a fast-paced revolution in the PEI school system. Lauren Mose was recruited as Assistant Deputy Minister of Education in 1967 and soon became deputy. Mose recalls, "When I came into the department, there was basically no organization. Every person except the secretaries in the department reported directly to the deputy. When I started, I wasn't married at the time. When I'd come home at night, I'd take a bunch of applications for student aid and deal with those, and take them back the next day to be processed. The deputy was hands-on with everything." Education called for considerable hands-on involvement by the minister, and more than occasionally by the premier. Correspondence and requests for meetings dealt with everything from teachers' licenses to student loans to school construction to curriculum. The latter produced the hottest letters, notably from citizens protesting against the inclusion of certain books on high school reading lists, with Ernest Buckler's Mountain and the Valley and J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye drawing the most fire. A letter from an Alberton man complained that the latter book was an indication of what he called the moral and spiritual depravity to which those who formulate the teaching programs for our youth have lowered themselves. After discussing the matter with curriculum people in the Department of Education and with the High School English Curriculum Committee, Gordon Bennett offered a carefully worded response, conceding, "Scattered throughout this book are words and expressions which are perhaps not in good taste. before adding that the selection of novels from the grade 12 reading list was up to the teacher, and that some schools had used the book with success. He also said that Catcher in the Rye represents a piece of good literature. Both the original letter and the minister's response were copied to the local MLA and to the premier. From his first days in office, Alex Campbell made it a policy to respond quickly and fully to correspondence. A grade 11 student in Montague, who had returned to school after being in the workforce for several years, wrote the premier to protest that he was not eligible to receive financial support for taking academic courses, while he would be paid a weekly wage if he were upgrading. The student underscored the extent of his financial stress by the fact that he had purchased a new car, which he could not sell and for which he had no income to make payments. Campbell responded to confirm that financial support was available for occupational training for adults through cooperative programs with the Canada Department of Manpower, but not for academic courses. The letter concluded, "You have mentioned your efforts to dispose of your new car, and I trust this matter can be resolved to your satisfaction. I sincerely wish that there was some way that we might be of assistance to you." A sophomore student at Prince of Wales wrote following the white paper on post-secondary education to protest that the Premier was uninformed and asking him to please reconsider the situation and do not hesitate to consult with those who know what is academically best for this island. Campbell's response was both pointed and gracious, including the following.
"I will be the first to admit that my knowledge of the academic world is not as complete as might be desired. However, I do believe that I have sought advice and information from people of the highest caliber. It was in light of such advice and consultation that the government decided to embark on this new program. In your letter, you made several broad and sweeping generalizations about higher education. I would hope that you might do more research on several of these statements before necessarily accepting their validity. I appreciate your comments and sincerely hope that you will continue to remain in the academic stream of Prince Edward Island in order to contribute to our province's overall development."
It was not uncommon for the Minister of Education or even Premier Campbell to be approached with individual complaints or appeals regarding teacher qualifications or salaries. In 1966, salaries for island teachers were lower than in other provinces. Elementary teachers received just over $3,000 per year on average, while the average salary for secondary teachers was almost $4,500. The system of teacher qualifications was arcane, with 10 different classes of licenses, plus an exceptional ministerial permit for the lowest qualified. In 1966, there were 39 teachers with ministerial permits, earning an average salary of $1,573. The minister played an active role in determining salaries, in dealing with special pleadings from teachers about their classification, and in receiving complaints about the quality of teaching. These approaches were sometimes addressed to the Premier, including occasional claims of loyalty to the Liberal cause. Lauren Mose recalls one incident shortly after he became Deputy Minister, when a teacher wrote to Education Minister Gordon Bennett asking for an upgrade in her teaching status, underscoring that she and her family had been good Liberals all their lives. Mose says, "When we looked in the file, one of the first things we found was a letter from the same teacher to Dr. George Dewar a few years before, when Dewar was Minister of Education in the Walter Shaw government, telling him what a great Conservative she was. To make a long story short, that one didn't go very far." There was no formal process for negotiating teacher salaries. The Prince Edward Island Teachers Federation would go cap in hand to the minister, and the minister would take it under consideration. When Gordon Bennett unveiled a new salary scale in early 1967 to take effect July 1st, the Federation protested that more than 50% of teachers had been ignored, as the announcement which appeared in the media made no mention of First Class A, First Class B, or Second Class teachers. The Federation's Board of Governors passed resolutions and met with the minister, who took the matter to Cabinet and announced a week later that there would likely be increases for civil servants included in the budget to be presented in the legislature, and that due consideration will also be given to increase the salaries of those members of the teaching profession who were not recognized in the recently announced increase due to go into effect July 1st of this year. it was widely evident that the arrangements for teacher salaries would need to change. A 1968 Guardian editorial offered the view that adequate teacher recruitment, indeed, may become our greatest headache, and the one calling for most urgent attention. When 30-year-old Sterling Stratton was recruited from New Brunswick in 1969 to be General Secretary of the Teachers' Federation, an early highlight was a phone call from the Premier's office inviting him to come for coffee. Stratton recalls,
"So I went up. I was immediately taken with the guy. He was charismatic. He was young. He looked like a Hollywood star. I was intimidated by the office and the big desk. After we were talking for a while, he said, 'I want to show you something.' He went to the filing cabinet and hauled out a file. It was letters of complaint about teachers. My first reaction, which I didn't say to him directly, was, 'What is the Premier doing accepting those letters?' I more or less said to him that those should be handled locally. We concluded our meeting on cordial terms, and I felt that I wanted to get to know him better."
Stratton was being introduced to the customs of Prince Edward Island and the expectations of islanders when it came to approaching government. They expected the Premier's door and his mailbox to be open, and Campbell was happy to oblige. The Premier didn't interfere with his ministers or micromanage, but when people approached him directly, they got his full attention. Or, in some cases, he sought them out, as he did by inviting the newly arrived Stratton up for a cup of coffee. Campbell treated letters from ordinary islanders the same way he treated people on the street. He wanted to know what they were thinking, what their problems were, and whether they were getting answers. While Alex Campbell enjoyed one-on-one interactions and sought them out, he understood the need for systems. By 1970, all provinces except Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland had collective bargaining for teachers. In October 1972, the PEI Teachers' Federation and the government signed their first collective agreement. This was achieved based on a no-strikes-with-binding-arbitration model of bargaining that was adopted after extensive study by a Cabinet Committee on Public Service Bargaining and by the Teachers' Federation. Collective agreements were subsequently concluded using the same model with school bus drivers and non-teaching staff, as well as with nurses and other public servants. By the mid-1970s, the employment arrangements for Prince Edward Island teachers and other public servants had moved a long way from the scene depicted in Robert Harris's 1885 painting, Meeting of the School Trustees, or for that matter, from the arrangements that persisted into the late 1960s.
School consolidation.
The greatest controversies for government came with decisions about school consolidation and location, plus the geographic configuration of school administrative units. Communities that were agreeable in principle to larger, more modern schools could be ferociously opposed if they felt that they were being asked to give up something or to travel too far. Shortly after being appointed minister, Gordon Bennett established a committee to provide advice on rationalization of the high school system. Lorne Most was appointed to the committee while he was the director of teacher education at Prince of Wales College. In February of 1967, Most travelled to a meeting in Tignish along with fellow committee members Don Anderson, Frank Spriggs McMillan, and Wilson Ross. Most says that they went with the idea that we were going to sell amalgamation of the three high schools in West Prince. There were approximately 500 people in attendance. The four committee members opened the meeting by each getting up and giving our spiel. Most says that it was going quite well until McMillan spoke, as the last of the four, and made the case for school rationalisation by citing the benefits that had come with the amalgamation of dairies. When McMillan finished, the first person who spoke challenged the comparison of the Tignish children to rolls of cheese, and concluded with an emphatic, "If you get out of here alive tonight, you'll be damned lucky." By the time the meeting ended and the committee members were departing for the 90-minute return drive, a winter storm had blown up to match the storm inside the hall. Most recalls vividly that, "All I could think was, let's make sure we get out of Tignish." As they approached O'Leary, the car went off the road and into the ditch. This was not the last time that attempts to address school rationalization or location would go off the road. During the Campbell years, there were 27 new schools opened throughout Prince Edward Island, 18 of them under the federal-provincial cost-sharing arrangements of the Comprehensive Development Plan. These changes inevitably produced controversies regarding location, communities of interest, travel times, educational pros and cons, and local politics and personalities. The hottest controversies surrounded the location of high schools in West Prince and East Prince. In December 1972, 8 of the 15 members of the Unit 1 school board resigned as they struggled to decide the location of high schools in West Prince, alleging that the Department of Education had usurped the role of the board. Donald McKenzie, one of the trustees who resigned, says that the board came to a standstill. George Henderson, who represented the Tyne Valley-Ellerslie area and was a vocal opponent of burdensome travel arrangements for students from the eastern end of the school unit, also resigned. Henderson subsequently rejoined the board, which reached a compromise to locate the new senior high school at the geographic center of the region. In addition, there were two new intermediate schools and two new elementary schools built in West Prince. Alex Campbell's only public intervention was to promise to build the schools where the board agreed to put them. Throughout the extended controversy over high schools in West Prince, Campbell remained on amicable terms with people on all sides. To this day, says Donald McKenzie, Alex could not have been more friendly. George Henderson was elected as a Liberal candidate in the 1974 election and became Minister of Fisheries and Labour. He says that it was never a problem for Campbell to come to West Prince. He loved people and it showed. No one could work a hall like Alex. One near casualty of the friction in West Prince was Education Minister Gordon Bennett, who became so frustrated during a cabinet discussion of the matter that he packed up his materials and left the room, leaving behind a letter of resignation. Alex Campbell asked Bruce Stewart and Bob Skuurman, two of his more conciliatory ministers, to go to Bennett's cottage in Stanhope and persuade him to return, which he did. In East Prince, a two-year controversy over high school construction was resolved by a compromise decision to build Three Oaks Senior High School in Summerside and to retain the regional high school in Kensington. Board Chairman Edwin Lewis credited personal relationships among board members for the resolution, observing, "In a compromise, each side must give something in the interest of the greater good." When matters became especially heated, Alex Campbell did not hesitate to get directly involved. Liberal organizers who were concerned that the East Prince school situation could blow up in advance of an expected 1974 election had Campbell attend a testy meeting in Kensington and do the speaking instead of the Minister of Education. Liberal campaign chair Mike Skuurman says, "Alex handled it beautifully. It all worked out." One of the most challenging public events of Campbell's premiership came on November 8, 1971, when he, Gordon Bennett, and Earl Hickey attended a meeting of about 600 people at Colonel Gray High School. The meeting was called by a phalanx of civic leaders, including the Charlottetown School Board and the United City Council, to make the case for Charlottetown to remain as a separate school district rather than be included in a larger unit comprising central and eastern Queens County. Campbell and Bennett were booed and jeered by the crowd. Bennett's Daily Diary commented that the cards were stacked against us from the word go. The underlying debate was about equalization, with the province's largest municipality wanting to retain control over educational resources and worried that Charlottetown might be held back while the rest of the unit caught up. The government stuck to its guns and included Charlottetown in the larger unit. If it had not done so, the argument for educational equality would have been lost and the whole purpose behind the school reforms derailed.
Education and the Development Plan.
Notwithstanding federal resistance on jurisdictional grounds, educational reform became a central feature of the Comprehensive Development Plan. This was as important in fiscal terms as it was substantively, as it meant that the province could count its educational spending as a contribution to match federal dollars being spent in other areas. The plan's basic objectives in education were to improve the quality of education, to double the proportion of students who complete grade 12, and in general to give the people of Prince Edward Island a flexible education system capable of overcoming short-term problems and meeting long-term needs. The province's strategies for attaining the plan's educational objectives were threefold. 1. Reorganization of provincial educational financing and full administrative integration of the system as a whole. 2. Development of highly qualified teaching personnel through upgrading and in-service training and through a realistic salary and professional structure. And 3. develop a system based on the most successful modern approaches to education. During the 1969 throne speech debate, Gordon Bennett outlined the new vision for education, including the reduction of more than 300 school boards to 6 administrative units, with an overall emphasis on equalizing educational opportunities. The extent of the transformation could be seen in specific measures, ranging from the elimination of grade 8 provincial examinations, to doing away with the annual fall potato picking vacation, to a new salary scheme that would see island teachers achieve parity with Nova Scotia and New Brunswick by 1972. The 1969 legislative session approved changes to the School Act, providing for the creation of larger administrative units with interim boards during the planning process, and leading to the establishment of what came to be known as the Educational Planning Unit. Much of the preparatory work for these changes was done at the Economic Improvement Corporation, where Richard Higgins had the lead on the file. Higgins and the EIC were frustrated with the Department of Education for being too conservative. During the 1969 legislative session, Del Gallagher and Hector Horty appeared in committee to discuss details of the development plan. When questioned about the inclusion of education in the CDP when it was a matter of exclusive provincial jurisdiction, Gallagher spoke about the critical role of education in development. He noted that the funding arrangements under the development plan would mean that federal dollars would be available to support primary and secondary education, and that additional resources would flow to vocational education. The province achieved a major breakthrough in early 1971 when the Development Plan's Joint Advisory Board agreed to set up a $24 million fund for school construction, with 50% of the funding provided through a federal grant, and the other 50% coming in the form of a federal low-interest loan to the province. This kicked off an aggressive 4-year program of school construction at the rate of $6 million per year. Premier Campbell estimated that provincial taxpayers would save $20 million in interest payments alone over a 20-year period, when compared with what it would cost the province to fund school construction through normal borrowing. The $24 million in combined grants and loans was made possible by redirecting funds otherwise earmarked under the CDP for a combination of areas, including fisheries, manpower, plan management, tourism, potato quality improvement, industrial credits, and above all, the amorphous development grant. Given that the development plan had been in operation for less than 2 years, and that the resources were vastly greater than anything previously available, the demand for programs in these areas was short of projections. The bottom line was that education was a higher priority.
Comprehensive reform.
The 1971 fall sitting of the legislature saw 3 milestones in PEI's educational reforms. Gordon Bennett unveiled a foundation program in a series of speeches, emphasizing the challenge to improve high school completion rates, which were still barely above 60%, to broaden the secondary school curriculum, and to adapt education to the contemporary economy and needs. The 11-point program included the objective of increasing retention rates to 76% by 1976-77 and to 80% by 1980-81. A further critical step was for the province to assume 100% of educational financing through general tax revenues, replacing the historic taxation role of local school boards. Bennett's speeches on the foundation program and public presentations by Premier Campbell in Montague and Summerside prompted The Guardian to complain in an editorial about statements on equality and fairness that The Guardian said were flooding out of government circles and thickening the air like a London fog. Legislative milestones from the 1971 fall session included a completely overhauled School Act, a new Real Property Tax Act, and a new Real Property Assessment Act, all to take effect July 1, 1972. At a meeting in Summerside to explain the new legislation, Campbell, Gordon Bennett, and Earl Hickey met with a group of 200 citizens who had questions on everything from assessment of farm property to whether school spirit could be maintained. Summerside School Board Chair Elmer Murphy expressed concern that with the province-wide system, the standards might not progress as they had in Summerside schools. In every presentation, Premier Campbell and Gordon Bennett emphasized that Charlottetown and Summerside had achieved high standards. Their overall view of the reforms was summarized in the statement, "Justice and equality were the basis for the tax reforms in the legislature last week."
Educational leadership.
In a cabinet shuffle in October of 1972, Bennett Campbell was named Minister of Education. While only 29 years of age, Campbell had 10 years of teaching experience in Prince Edward Island and Montreal schools. Gordon Bennett remained as Minister of Justice and Attorney General, as well as Provincial Secretary and President of Executive Council. An editorial in the Evening Patriot acknowledged Bennett's contribution, commenting that the education portfolio has indeed been a tough assignment these past couple of years, and saying that Bennett had faced his educational problems fairly and squarely. The editorial concluded, "We haven't by any stretch of the imagination agreed with him on all occasions, but we have admired his integrity and his devotion." As the educational reforms, including the construction program, rolled out between 1972 and 1978, one of the most striking features was the caliber of citizens who served on the unit school boards or who took part in other processes, such as the educational planning unit. Fulfilling these roles frequently brought local community leaders into heated debates and controversies, requiring patience, difficult choices, leadership, and compromise. For many school board members, their roles on post-1971 bodies were an extension of involvements under the previous system. The pre-1971 school boards did Alex Campbell a big favor by massaging issues of religion out of the education system. The final tipping point was the opening of Colonel Gray High School in 1966, together with the implementation of zoning in Charlottetown in 1967, thereby ending a system of segregation that had been in place for 8 decades. Cooler heads on the Summerside School Board, including Earl Hickey, did the province a major service in 1961 when they headed off a push for separate schools. It could be argued that the informal quotas for representation based on religion that prevailed in many school boards prior to 1972 helped to focus community attention on recruiting the best people to serve. It is noteworthy that at least 5 of Alex Campbell's strongest cabinet ministers, Earl Hickey, John Maloney, Bruce Stewart, Dan MacDonald, and George Henderson, came to provincial politics with school board experience. While it was the original intent that some of the trustees of the new unit school boards would be appointed by executive council, the government relented to public pressure to have them all elected.
Reform impetus and limitations.
The educational reforms between 1966 and the mid-1970s truly amounted to a decade of cramming. While some people were impatient with the pace of change, it helps to remember that 252 one-room schools were phased out between 1966 and 1972, that more than 400 school districts were amalgamated into 5 regional units, that a province-wide system of property taxation and assessment was introduced, that 27 new schools were opened between 1966 and 1978, that high school completion rates improved from 58% to almost 80%, and that the proportion of teachers with university degrees increased from 26% to 88% between 1969 and 1978. What made these revolutionary changes possible? After all, the Prince Edward Island school system had resisted reform for almost a century. High-profile commissions and committees had called for the consolidation of school districts and other reforms in 1910, 1930, 1945, and 1959, only to have their recommendations sit on a shelf. Among the explanations for why the consistent recommendations for school consolidation and more efficient administration were not acted upon, the most fundamental reason is transportation. Until after the Second World War, the winter and spring conditions of island roads were not suited for transporting students any distance to school. A second controlling factor was money. Province-wide school consolidation entailed a huge bill for school construction, transportation, teacher salaries, and operating costs. A third factor holding back change was the disparities that existed from district to district, meaning that change would entail inevitable debates about gainers and losers. As late as 1971, Charlottetown and Summerside resisted change on this ground. A fourth significant factor was local identity. Generations of families had grown up with local kinship and support systems, oral histories, geographic specificities such as rivers, bays, hills, and roads, community organizations and businesses, sports teams, and rivalries with neighboring communities. Not least among the factors favoring the status quo, the system of local school districts enabled the accommodation of religious diversity. By 1966, many of the reasons not to change were turned on their head. Instead of gainers and losers, people were ready to hear about equalization. Instead of insisting on religious difference or even segregation, the community wanted to work together. Instead of local identities or parochialism, Islanders wanted to be on the move and with the crowd, especially the young people. Most of all, it was widely acknowledged that education was essential to growth and development, individually and collectively, and that the previous system was inadequate. Still, the changes would not have happened without a massive infusion of resources, a revolutionary overhaul of policies and institutions, and leadership at all levels. Ironically, as Alex Campbell approached his fourth election in 1978, the issue of school consolidation started to turn against him. The tide began to ebb by 1976, as reflected in a statement of the impact of school consolidation on local communities and the quality of education issued by the PEI Federation of Home and School Associations. The statement called for the consolidation of the consolidated to be re-examined and for a moratorium on the construction of new schools until their impact on communities and the quality of education was better understood. The Federation said that serious consideration should be given to the needs of people and communities, not simply numbers and administrative guidelines. UPEI Professor Werner Smitherum says that when tensions over school consolidation were fully vented, the controversy was matched only by the Bible question of 100 years earlier. One flashpoint was the proposed closure of elementary schools in the Borden area. Premier Campbell intervened to help find a solution sympathetic to the parents. An attempt to raise questions about school consolidation at a 1978 Liberal election rally in Montague led to a flare-up that introduced a sour note into the campaign. The general debate about the pros and cons of consolidation fed into larger debates about bigness versus smallness, or modernization versus the traditional island way of life. These debates coincided with the contrast between Conservative leader Angus Maclean's rural renaissance and Alex Campbell's decade of cramming. Maclean accused Campbell of talking one way and acting another, and lumped school consolidation together with an accusation that Campbell favored larger firms over smaller family ones and emphasized Charlottetown-based industries to the neglect of those elsewhere. Campbell took seriously the critique that the schools were too large and requested an analysis of the schools built before and after 1966. His principal secretary, Len Bradley, responded that only 8 schools built since 1966 had a capacity of more than 500 students, while 13 schools built prior to 1966 were of the larger scale. The anti-consolidation arguments arose late in the cycle and reflected a broader array of concerns about the pace and scale of change. As longtime school principal and educational leader Charles Campbell commented in a 1975 reflection on 70 years of consolidation, no one was going back to the one-room schools. Dr. George Dewar, who served as education minister for 7 years prior to Alex Campbell's 1966 election, retained an active interest in the field. Dewar put the changes in the PEI school system in appreciative perspective in his 1993 memoir, commenting, "The children of West Prince now have a modern, well-organized school system with well-qualified, well-paid instructors for academic and vocational work. This has indeed been quite a revolution since 1960, when only the brilliant and the affluent were able to succeed in spite of the system. The revolution happened because education was an uppermost priority for the Campbell government and for the Prince Edward Island community. It would not have been sustained for the 12 years of Alex Campbell's premiership without his determination and good-natured leadership."